The Bible tells us that Abraham had three wives. Most are familiar, I think, with his first wife. That would be Sarah. Abraham and Sarah, if you think back to their relationship, did not immediately have a son. And they wanted a child, so they came up with a plan. The plan was that Abraham would take a second wife, that would be Hagar, and through her have a child. Well, that plan was successful. Through Abraham and Hagar, there arrived a son by the name of Ishmael. So after Ishmael came into the world, Abraham had two wives, Sarah and Hagar, and one child, Ishmael. After some time passed, Abraham had a second son. And that second son, of course, was Isaac, and the mother of Isaac was Sarah. After Sarah died, and the Bible does tell us about her death, Abraham married a third woman. And the third woman was a lady by the name of Keturah. We read about her in Genesis 25, verse 1. In Genesis 25, verse 2, we find that there were six children that came from the relationship that Abraham had with this third wife. Now, when we think about these three women, Abraham was married to Hagar and to Sarah and to Keturah. We find that only one of these wives, Sarah, would be a wife in the sense that our culture uses this word. The other two women, that would be Keturah and that would be Hagar, were women in what we might call a secondary sense. Hagar and Keturah were ladies that were classified as concubines. A concubine described a female slave who was really a secondary wife and a surrogate mother. There were exceptions in Bible times, but basically the sons that came from a concubine did not receive as much or a great family inheritance. They got a lot less of the family wealth. Now, we've been asked to hold in readiness two passages, Genesis 25, and we're going to be Genesis 25, Genesis 16, and some places close to that. And then we're going to look at Galatians chapter 4. If you've gone back to Genesis 25, I want to look at the information in Genesis 25, verse 6. But unto the sons of the concubines, and this, of course, would refer to Hagar and Keturah, but unto the sons of the concubines that Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts, and he sent them away from Isaac his son while he yet lived, eastward unto the east country. All right, notice this point. Abraham's sons that came through the concubines, Keturah and Hagar, received gifts. And after these gifts were received by these children, they were sent away, shipped off, if you will, into the eastward country. Now remember that Abraham had a third wife. The third wife was Sarah, and from Sarah came Isaac. Now, we know how the sons of the concubines were treated. Let's go and see how the son of Sarah, this full wife, if you will, was treated. Genesis 25, backing up one verse to verse 5. And Abraham gave how much? All that he had unto Isaac. Isaac was that full son's wife, and he got the best and the rest of what dad had. So there is in Genesis 25 a very clear, a very strong contrast between what the sons who came from a concubine got and what the son from Sarah received. Now, that's not very difficult to understand. That should be clear to all of us. The significance, though, of this point may not, however, have been something that has really registered with us. As I said, the other passage that we want to look at tonight somewhat extensively is found in the Galatian letter. In Galatians chapter 4, it's here in Galatians 4 that Paul goes back and talks about what we have as far as the information in places like Genesis chapter 25. I want to start with Galatians 4 and look at the information in verse 22. He said, "For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the handmaid and one by the free woman." Paul knew that Abraham had two sons through two wives. Now, we know that's not literally true because he actually had three wives, but that's not the point of the comparison. Paul's just at this point in his argument picking up two of those wives, the wives, of course, being Sarah, and the other wife was Hagar. In the verses that follow in Galatians 4, Paul makes it clear that he's talking about these two women. Paul knew that one of Abraham's wives, that of course would be Hagar, she was the lady who had a son, and Paul says this child was from the handmaid, that is Hagar. And this boy, as we've mentioned, was the son named Ishmael. And after introducing Hagar and Ishmael, Paul says there was this second son, the son of the free woman, that of course would be a reference to Sarah and her son Isaac. Isaac and Ishmael are the two sons who are described in Galatians 4. And Paul says these two sons, as well as their mothers, were very, very special. In fact, these two sons and their mothers pointed forward to some things. Let's look at Galatians 4, verse 24. And for now, we just want to look at the first part of the verse. Which things, that is, these relationships, these two women, these two sons, he says, which things contain an allegory? Ishmael and Isaac, Hagar and Sarah are an allegory. That is, their lives, the things that they were involved with, they pointed forward to many things at a later time. That would be the New Testament era. Just as Adam and Noah and the ark pointed forward to various things in the New Testament, such was true for these two boys and their moms. These boys and their moms pointed forward to some truths that should be familiar to us since we live under the New Testament era. For example, we read in Galatians 4 that these two boys, and especially the two mothers, pointed to two different covenants. The Old Testament, represented by Hagar, and the New Testament, represented by Sarah. Now remember, as we think about Hagar, that she was a concubine. She was that secondary wife, that surrogate mother. But Sarah, on the other hand, was not a secondary wife. She was a wife who had all the rights, all the status, all the privileges that a wife could have. Well, now Hagar, as she is in that secondary status, was that just tough luck? Did that just happen to be her lot in life? Or was this part of God's great plan? Hagar probably didn't realize it, but that status that she had as a secondary wife, that lowly class that she found herself in, was actually part of God's master plan. We read the first part of Galatians 4:24. Let's read the rest of the verse. Which things contain an allegory? For Paul said, these women, that would be Hagar and that would be Sarah, these women are two covenants. One from Mount Sinai bearing children under bondage, which is Hagar. And then, of course, he goes on and implies some information about Sarah. If we look carefully in the book of Genesis and study Galatians 4, we find some pretty amazing stuff. The secondary wife status of Hagar, the things that she endured, and it was in many respects a miserable life. Her life pointed forward to the Old Testament that was given to the Jewish people. Here in Galatians 4, as Paul talks about this woman and as he refers to the Old Testament, he says the Lady Hagar, she represented that state of bondage. Hagar looked forward to the system that Moses was associated with, that old covenant. Today, I am amazed at the number of people who, for one reason or another, want to go back and live under some part of the Old Testament law. Some want to go back and say, well, let's observe the Sabbath day. Or others would go back and say, let's do what the Jews did when it came to giving. Others would go back and say, well, let's follow some of the dietary laws. Let's look at the restrictive food laws, and let's go back and put ourselves under those rules. Galatians 4 says that Old Testament system was a way of bondage. It was like a yoke or a chain around the neck. It was an undesirable way to live. It was the way of slavery and hardship. It was like being a secondary wife. Sarah is not specifically mentioned in Galatians 4, but she and her status as a full wife are implied. The information in verse 22, Abraham had two sons, tells us that Paul is also thinking about Sarah and her son Isaac. Hagar pointed to the Old Testament. Sarah, though, and her status as a full wife pointed forward to the New Testament. One of Abraham's wives pointed forward to the law of Moses. The other pointed forward to the law of Christ. Long before the Old Testament was ever instituted, Galatians 4 and the book of Genesis tells us that God had plans to institute a New Testament. When we look at the God of the Bible, he is not a God who, as time passes, says, well, I have to adjust my plan. I didn't see this coming, so let's tweak this and let's fix this and let's correct this. No, God has a master plan. The master plan was in his mind before the world was created, and as the days and the months and the years go by, that plan simply continues to unfold. In addition to these two women representing the two covenants, we find something else. The births of Isaac and Ishmael also pointed forward to two churches. The birth of Ishmael, as we think about his coming into the world, it was a birth that did not involve any kind of supernatural activity. He and Abraham got together, and Abraham and Hagar got together, and Ishmael came from that union. Well, that's parallel to what we find with the Jews and the Old Testament system. When we look at the Old Covenant, how did the Jewish people become a member of that Old Testament system? Was there anything special? Was there anything supernatural? Was there anything that, you know, God had said had to be done? No. the Jews were simply born into that system. If you were born and you were a Jewish individual, you automatically became a member of that covenant. Acts 7:38 talks about the church in the wilderness. That, of course, being a reference to the nation of Israel. The Hebrew nation was a church in the sense that it was God's special group of people. And to get into this spiritual body, or this Jewish church, if you will, the Hebrew people did not have to do a single thing. It was automatic. They received automatic status. But when the New Testament came into being, things changed. You may remember, and this was a great surprise to Nicodemus in John chapter 3. Jesus taught this Jewish teacher that a person must be born anew. And Nicodemus was amazed. He's kind of scratching his head thinking, well, that's a lot different, you know, than what we've done in the past. But Jesus said a man must be born anew or born again. Ishmael, who represented that Old Testament covenant, was born without any kind of divine intervention. But what about the son Isaac? We know that with Isaac, God had to have a special hand. There had to be a birth from above. There was supernatural activity that was involved in the birth of Isaac. Sarah and Isaac not only pointed forward to God's new agreement with man, they pointed forward to the fact that the birth process, how a person would become a member of the covenant, that was going to change. And Jesus, as we said in John 3, described that as being born anew or born from above. Physical birth no longer allows us to come into God's covenant automatically. We have to be born of the Spirit. We've got to hear the Spirit's word and do what he says. The circumstances surrounding the birth of Isaac and Ishmael are different because the covenants and the way that we enter the covenants are different. The Old Testament symbolized by Ishmael and Hagar did not symbolize freedom. As we already heard from Galatians 4, this mom, this son represented bondage. But as we think about Sarah, and as we think about her son Isaac, they were associated with freedom. In Galatians 5, verse 1, Paul said, "For freedom did Christ set us free. Stand fast, therefore, and be not entangled again in the yoke of bondage." We, as we think about what Sarah and Isaac stand for, the New Testament, the freedom that they offer, we should be grateful. We should be thankful to God every single day because we live under a New Testament, a new agreement. We should also, as we think about Sarah and Isaac, be thankful that God is wise enough and powerful enough to have planned this whole thing out a long time ago. When we study Ishmael and Isaac, we find yet another very strange detail. I said we're going to look at some other passages in the book of Genesis, and our next reference is going to come a few chapters earlier from where we were, Genesis 16. I think most of us have probably read this information several times, but if we've not connected it with Galatians 4, the allegory that Paul talks about, we might think, that's very, very interesting. In Genesis 16, we have a time where Hagar is pregnant. Ishmael has not yet been born. And Hagar is fleeing from her master or mistress, Sarah. And as Hagar has fled out into the wilderness, there is a heavenly visitor who is identified as the angel of Jehovah. And the angel of Jehovah says something that's very interesting and somewhat strange until we view it in terms of the New Testament. Genesis 16, verses 11 and 12. "And the angel of Jehovah said unto her, Behold, thou art with child, and you're going to bear a son." This, of course, was Ishmael, and the Ishmael's name. "Because Jehovah hath heard thy affliction." And notice verse 12. "And he shall be as a wild ass among men. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell over against all thy brethren." Now think with me for a moment about this information and the contrast that Paul offers in Galatians chapter 4. Sarah and Isaac, Paul says in Galatians 4, represent the New Testament era and the things associated with that, which would include the church. Hagar and her son Ishmael, however, pointed forward to the Old Testament system, the Jewish nation, the law of Moses. In Genesis 16, verses 11 and 12, the angel of Jehovah shows up and says to Hagar, "You're going to have a son. And this boy, Ishmael, is going to stir up some trouble. He's going to be a tough fellow to handle. He's going to be a rowdy child. He's going to have the kind of personality where he's going to be like a wild man." Ultimately, this rowdy, wild, rebellious character looked forward to something. It looked forward to what the Jews were going to do to God's people once the New Testament church was instituted. Think about what we find in the New Testament when it comes to Christians and the Jewish people. We find in the book of Acts that the Jews persecuted God's people time and time again. They chased them out of Jerusalem. There were times where the Jews tried to stone people like Paul or kill them. The Jews were often very, very angry. The information about Ishmael in Genesis 16, verses 11 and 12, points forward to that Jewish opposition. We might describe the point this way. When we see that Jewish opposition or that Jewish persecution in the book of Acts, it is really a fulfillment of a prophecy back here in Genesis 16, verses 11 and 12. When we think about these two boys, Ishmael and Isaac, and their mothers, Hagar and Sarah, some other parallels become evident. Do we remember some details from Genesis 21? It may be beneficial to go back over there for just a minute and look at a verse or two. By the time we get to Genesis 21, Ishmael has been born. And there is a series of events that takes place. You may remember the party that took place and how Isaac was mocked. And Sarah gets to a point where she says to her husband, "Cast out, get rid of your son Ishmael, and you get rid of this woman, this wife Hagar. They've got to go." We probably remember that information, Genesis 21, verse 10. Abraham did this. And Genesis 21, verse 14 tells us what Ishmael, this son of Abraham, received after he was cast out. I want to read this verse, and then I want to think through it with us. "And Abraham rose up early in the morning and took bread and a bottle of water and gave it unto Hagar, putting it on her shoulder, and gave her the child and sent her away. And she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba." Now, imagine this. You have a wife and you have a son. And someone in your family says they've got to go. Kick them out of the house. And you agree that you will do that. And as you send your son and as you send your wife packing, you give them only two provisions. You send with them as they leave your house a bottle of water, and you give them a stash of bread. What kind of inheritance is that for a son? "Here, son, is what you get. You get some bread and you get some water. That's what you get for being my son." Well, that's a pretty pitiful, that's a pretty miserable inheritance. But this pitiful, this small, this insignificant inheritance pointed to something. Remember again Paul's point in Galatians chapter 4. Ishmael and Hagar pointed to that Old Testament system. What did the Jews inherit under the Old Testament law? Well, they got the land of Canaan. The bottle of water and the bread in Genesis 21. As far as I can tell, symbolized the inheritance that was received by the Jewish people when they got the land of Canaan. Isaac and his mother, though, who represent the New Testament system or Christianity, were treated very differently. Sarah, as we've mentioned, had that full status of a wife. Isaac, as we read earlier, he didn't get just the gift, but Isaac got it all. As we heard from Genesis 25, verse 5, he got the true inheritance. If we take nothing else from this lesson, I hope we'll at least understand and take home this much, because this is a very important point. The inheritance that was received by the nation of Israel is described with the image of a bottle of water and some bread. That's how the land of Canaan and all the things, the land that was flowing with milk and honey, that's how God pictured that inheritance. That becomes very interesting when we look at people today. When they think about what the Jews received, the land and that the grapes and all the produce and all the things that were associated with the land of Canaan. A lot of people, that's the kind of inheritance that they want. But God says that's crazy thinking. That inheritance, that physical inheritance, God says, when compared to the spiritual inheritance that we have in this life and will have in eternity, God says that inheritance was pitiful. It is like a bottle of water and it is like a sack of bread. If we are a Christian, the spiritual blessings that we have in Christ right now are off the chart. But a lot of times we find Christians, they go through the life, they don't have any clue as far as the spiritual wealth that they possess in this life, and they're really clueless about what they're going to have in eternity. It is a great, a powerful, and important contrast. One more. In Galatians chapter 4, verse 30, and we'll not read that verse, but if you were to look over there, and you'll probably remember this, and we've already talked about it, you will see that Ishmael and Hagar, who represented that Old Testament system, were cast out. Why did God ensure that this woman and her son were cast out? Well, the answer is not difficult. What did they represent? They represented that Old Testament system that was associated with Moses. What has happened with that Old Testament system? It's been done away with. We've been cut off from that. Jesus has brought in a New Testament, and that was symbolized thousands of years ago by the fact that Ishmael and his mother were cast out of the house. That Old Testament, God said, which was symbolized by these two, was going to be replaced by something else. If people simply studied Galatians chapter 4, they would know that the Old Testament is old and the New Testament is new. They'd understand the difference between the two. When we start looking at these two women and these two children, we find that the Scriptures are an amazing book, a stunning book when we look at God's Word. We also find that the God who wrote this book is an amazing God. He's far beyond our ability to fully understand him or appreciate him. And yet this amazing God, as we look at his wonderful word, says to us, I love you. And not only do I love you, but I want to help you. I want to bless you. Not only do I want to help you in this life, I want to care for you throughout all eternity. When we go back and look and see how God was able to use things in the Old Testament to point forward to the new, how he has this great master plan that's been unfolding for thousands of years, and how anyone could possibly turn down God's offer of salvation, that is beyond me. But today there are still people who, as they go through their lives, will look at God and say, well, no thanks, I'm not all that interested in your offer. How sad, how tragic. And it's my conviction that when people finally come to meet God on the day of judgment, one of the things that will cause them eternal sorrow is that they will have a glimpse of God in his honor, his glory, his power, his wisdom, and say, wow, there were a lot of things I missed, or there were a lot of things in life that I could have missed out on and live without it. But I have missed out on the greatest thing of all. The God of the Bible is a spectacular God, and his word demonstrates, it just gives us some glimpses of how wonderful he is. And tonight, we hope that you are someone who is committed to him. You are one of his people because you believe in him. And you believe that his way is the best way. So you've repented. You've confessed him. If we have some understanding of God, confession is a natural response. And you've been joined to him by baptism. To have your sins washed away, to be part of a spiritual body, and then to live to the best of your ability, faithfully in a service every single day. The God of the Bible wants you to be one of his people. And it's the greatest privilege on earth. We hope that's a decision that you've made and are continuing to make every single day of your life. If it's not, and tonight we can help you begin that walk by becoming a Christian, if we can help restore you to come back and to see the joy and the glory of God in your life, we let us know about either of those needs or another as we stand and sing the selected song.
Abide with thee. there's anyone who did not have the opportunity to partake of the Lord's Supper this morning, please come forward. There's no further announcements.